Welcome back to Food Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, the instructor for the course. Well, this morning, as I was walking through my vegetable garden in my backyard, I did a little bit of interaction with food toxicology. Of course, I've got the usual home gardener's array of vegetables, but I noticed that along the periphery, near the fence line, there were some other plants that I recognized as perhaps being a challenge in terms of food toxicology. Interestingly enough, what I noticed was in the local ecology of my garden, there were three types of plants, all of the same species. Two of those would be a welcome addition to any individual's dinner table, yet the third one would be an unwelcome poisonous plant. The three plants in my garden here that I brought as examples are my tomatoes here, and you can see the green fruits of the tomato plant. Tomato plants have been cultivated over decades to reduce the amount of the alkaloids, the tomato alkaloids, that occur in them so that they, in fact, are a very edible vegetable. This, with the white flowers here, is the tops of a potato plant, although you don't eat the tops here, primarily because they do contain significant amounts of poisonous alkaloids. We have successfully developed cultivars where the tuber has very low levels of these naturally occurring toxicants. And then over in the fence line, I noticed a very distinctive purple flower with some green berries on it. Again, another member of the Solanae family. This is commonly referred to as deadly nightshade, one of the most toxic plants in North America. Interesting in terms of giving us pause to kind of examine what is the relationship of humans to this greater ecology, and especially our relationship with respect to food. The title of today's lecture, Natural Toxins in Plants and Fungi, The Ecological Biochemistry of Food, is an attempt to introduce you to some of those plant, and plant and animal relationships of which, as high predators, high in the food chain, we are a part of our ecology. Our learning objectives here today, what we're going to do is try to understand this relationship between ecology and the human food chain. We're going to try to define a term for you, a study area of ecological biochemistry. Many of us have an understanding of what ecology is, and always we also have because of the prerequisites of this course, an understanding of what biochemistry is. What happens when we look at these biomolecules in an ecological perspective? We're going to try to explain some of these biochemical adaptations that occur in nature and the roles in terms of the generation of secondary chemical compounds in plants, these phytochemicals. Why are they there? What are they doing? How do they have a relationship in terms of ecological adaptation and survival in biology? We're going to try to examine the impacts of plant toxicants in the human food chain. How does it happen that perhaps toxicants develop in the human food chain, ending in human toxicosis? We're going to survey some examples of plant toxicants. We're not going to be comprehensive in this, obviously. One could make a good part of their life a study of the wide range of phytochemicals and their potential for toxicosis. We'll introduce you to some just to give you, again, an example. We'll try as well to review a range of plant-based supplements. Herbs and alternative medical therapies and supplements have become a large part of the American and global marketplace. It's a significant part. These products, although many of them have medicinal effects, are actually marketed as food and food supplements. We'll explore some of these plant compounds, not only for their activity, but also for the risks involved in some of their components. We'll finish up with a review of a range of poisonous mushrooms. We'll dip over into another life form, if you will, to explore, again, not in a comprehensive way, but in an introductory way, some of the risks associated with mushrooms that have compounds that are toxic to humans. Well, we want to explore the relationship of the human food chain and ecology, so we'll need a working definition of ecology. This is the scientific study of the distribution and abundance of living organisms, and this is key, the interactions between those organisms and their environment, and some of those interactions can be food interactions. The word ecology comes from the Greek roots, oikos meaning household, logos meaning study, so we're studying our household, perhaps. Here in food toxicology, perhaps we're studying the kitchen of that household. In terms of the ecological point of view of the human food chain, it's good for us to somewhat understand the concept of who eats who and what eat what. What eats what in the human food chain? And think of this perhaps as a broader ecology of food. How we produce food, the transit and transportation of nutrients, but also potential secondary chemical compounds and toxicants throughout the human food chain. This will invite a molecular level analysis, and this molecular level analysis in the ecology of food is a principal component of food toxicology. Now, in order to understand the ecology of food, we have to understand the relationship of ecological biochemistry. And this is simply a coupling of the observational science of ecology, where we study these interactions, and we take it a step further and introduce the molecular science of biochemistry. If we look at the five kingdoms as represented in this figure on this slide, we can see that there are interactions and interrelationships between the five kingdoms. I'll invite you to ask and think about your last meal and how many kingdoms were in your diet in this past meal. In terms of ecological biochemistry, we deal with examining the synthesis and biotransformation and transformation of chemicals in the environment. It can be the result of biochemical processes within an organism in terms of natural or in response to a stress. Principally, why these happen is somewhat to aid in species survival. Some of the interactions can include a biochemical adaptation, and this can be just something where there's a biosynthesis and sometimes a bioactivation of a compound found in that animal's dietary system. There can be detoxification where, in fact, in terms of the chemical warfare or the biochemical warfare, if you will, between plants and plants and animals, there can be a mechanism of detoxifying those chemical challenges. Some of those processes can be by biodegradation or biomineralization, sometimes, for example, with bacteria, taking a potential toxicant and through evolutionary multi-generational adaptation, changing that toxicant into a foodstuff. We can also find bioaccumulation and perhaps in some cases biomagnification up a food chain, and there is a potential for ecological biochemical interaction on the micro scale and also on the macro scale. Now, how does this happen in terms of biochemical adaptation? It comes to us from a metabolic flexibility of the living organism to fit into its environment. It will improve that organism's chances for survival. We have two types, major types of biochemical adaptation. We have evolutionary, and that takes many generations for an organism to evolve the appropriate adaptation to an environmental stress. We also have acclimatization. Acclimatization is much more rapid. It's within the lifetime of the organism, and this is perhaps a low dose response. What doesn't kill you will make you stronger. Our challenge as scientists is to help decipher the strategy of the natural world around us. What is going on in this biochemical warfare? How do we understand this better? Perhaps how do we use this for our own survival, not only in terms of dietary survival, but perhaps to use or better use the properties of nature, such as medicinals, to help us conquer our own challenges in terms of disease. One example in terms of that is the understanding of toxic plants in our environment. Now, in terms of the relationships in ecological biochemistry, we have competitive and symbiotic interactions. So these can involve, for instance, secondary plant compounds in plant-to-plant relationships and plant-to-animal relationships. We can also see animal-to-animal relationships in the productions of venoms and toxins in terms of competitive interrelationships. I put a picture here of the monarch butterfly. In terms of ecological biochemistry, it's a classic example. The monarch butterfly, very brightly colored to let everyone, in terms of predators, know it's there and who it is, actually feeds on the milkweed plant. This particular plant produces a wide range of cardinolids and glycosides that get bioprocessed by this insect, not only for its own uses, but it essentially sequesters and bioaccumulates these plant toxins. These plant toxins are very bitter and poisonous. When the blue jay comes along and perhaps tries to eat its first monarch butterfly, it experiences this bitter toxic taste, and it learns very quickly that these brightly colored insects are not going to be a common part of its diet. Now, in terms of toxins and survival strategy, we need to kind of step away and perhaps examine this in a broader context. As organisms synthesize or use toxins in their survival strategy, perhaps what is the ecological and perhaps an evolutionary interpretation of these secondary plant compounds? I have a quote here from 1975, the most conspicuous non-event in the history of angiosperms is the failure of insects and other herbivores to attack plants on a wide scale. And why is this so interesting? Well, because plants dominate the landscape, and thus they must be broadly repellent or toxic to animals in the broadest sense, because they can't move. Whereas herbivores, be it insects or higher animals, do have the ability to move. And so there is this animal-plant interrelationship in terms of the struggle to survive. One of the hypotheses developed about the production of secondary plant compounds and phytochemicals is that they were developed in plants as a survival mechanism. This gives the plant an offensive and defensive biosynthetic capability. It can be induced in biochemical warfare, but these chemical defenses are not only for a defensive strategy, sometimes they can affect palatability. Many phytochemicals have either a good or a bad taste. It can induce bitterness or, for instance, in many of the foods you eat, a palatable flavor, a desirable flavor. We're not so far off other animals that have selectivity in their diet in terms of going after specific types of foodstuffs because of palatability. These secondary plant chemical compounds in plants have variable structures and properties and mode of actions. There's high variation as well in where they are in the plant, whether it's in the stems, roots, leaves, flowers, fruits. There can be variability not only in the stage of maturity in the plant in terms of the concentration, but also in the species and the growing conditions of the specific plant involved. What we'll do on the next few slides is actually go through several lists of example secondary plant compounds, phytochemicals, in their broad category. In this listing, these are nitrogen compounds. We have the alkaloids, and we've learned this morning about the types of alkaloids in potatoes, tomatoes, and in toxic variety of solanine called deadly nightshade. These alkaloids are toxic and bitter quite often. There's a lot of structures, about 6,500 in the plant kingdom. With toxic amines, these are often repellent, hallucinogenic. There's many categories of those. Many toxic amino acids in plants. Cyanogenic glycosides, we've learned about those, for instance, in apricot pits and in, for example, English ivy. Many of these are poisonous as they can develop cyanide gas in gastrointestinal tract. The glucosinolates are a group of compounds that are very acrid and bitter. In some cases, they have strong insecticidal activity, so they help the plant compete better. Glucosinolates are common in the human diet. They give us the zing in horseradish. Give us the zing in some of the mustards that we eat. In terms of the terpenoids, another category, broad category of phytochemicals, there's about 1,000 monoterpenes. These give us pleasant smells, the nice smells as you walk through a pine forest. Sesquiterpene lactones, these are bitter toxic compounds. Quite often you find these in flowering range plants. Typically the bitterness makes them unpalatable, and it's also a signal to grazing animals that there is probably some phytochemicals that are going to be undesirable from a food toxicology point of view. There's diterpenoids, limonoids. If you've used the zest of lemon in a recipe, in the skin, you've exposed yourself to the bitterness of limonoids, which we use as a flavoring. Cucurbitins, like the bitterness in a cucumber peel. The cardenolids from, for instance, the milkweed, these are toxic and bitter compounds. As we saw, the monarch butterfly actually uses this particular class of compounds in their survival strategy. The carotenoids, beta carotene, gives us colors to our fruits and vegetables. We've got another broad category of phenolics. There's many of these. In terms of simple phenols, some of these are antimicrobial, helping the plant, again, compete against microbes. Flavonoids, some of these color compounds, there's a variety of these. Many of these have antioxidant properties that are sought after in terms of nutraceutical development. The quinones, these are often colored compounds. They are sometimes toxic. We'll talk here in a moment about a specific quinone, jugolone, from the walnut tree. The walnut tree is an example of secondary chemicals and perhaps our attempt to decipher the strategy of what might be referred to as the biochemical interaction between this particular plant and its environment. The definition of that interaction is allelopathy. This particular interaction is a broad-based study of the chemical interactions in the plant and animal kingdom. Since the time of ancient Greece, we have noted the potential toxicity of the walnut tree and its particular leaves and branches. It has been observed to kill nearby vegetation, a pretty good strategy in terms of survival of that plant. Its toxicant is moderately toxic to some insects, horses, dogs, and humans. In the 1500s, the physicians had a doctrine of signatures. This doctrine of signatures was a relationship between humans and their environment that suggested that plants that looked like organs of the human body had some sort of medicinal relationship. So, for instance, the medicinal called liverwort was a plant that was shaped like, that had leaves shaped like a liver, and therefore was viewed by these individuals, these physicians, as having a medicinal relationship to liver. The walnut was one of the plant compounds that were plant materials that was in the doctrine of signatures. Because the walnut itself looked like the brain, it was supposed that this was a good medicinal for all things having to do with the human brain. Well, the walnut tree produces a bound form of this toxin, jugolone, and deposits in nearby soil through leaves, nutshells, stems, and roots. The way we look at this, this bound form of this toxin is released on leaching and hydrolysis with water in natural environments. The oxidation product is a 5-hydroxynaphthoquinone or jugolone. This is the herbicide that actually is quite potent. Next time you're near a walnut tree, look below it, and you'll see that if in fact this is a naturally environment, it's not on someone's lawn where the leaves and the branches are swept up on a regular basis, you'll notice perhaps an herbicidal activity in terms of the relationship of this tree and the area beneath it that the leaves would fall on. Well, one of the points I want to make in today's lecture is that when we're dealing with the human food chain, virtually all foods and food animal feeds contain some potential naturally occurring toxicant. Okay? This is important because in our society we have chosen through media to perhaps isolate natural as being good and non-toxic, and anything that man has touched as or involved in synthetic processing or technology is bad. The human food chain can and has been very toxic in history, and it will continue to be toxic in terms of those that are still consuming perhaps on the periphery of the human food chain where there's an interaction with potential toxicants. What differentiates non-toxic from toxic in terms of plants and plant materials? Dose is the answer. Is there sufficient concentration? And we can look at the answer to this question that Paracelsus gave us, the father of modern toxicology, that the dose makes the poison. We can look at that quantitative relationship on a dose response curve and look for that no observed adverse effect level. In terms of working up a calculated hazard or risk, we can do that by looking at how we have minimized the presence of these toxicants by crop breeding and the development of various cultivars. By traditional means of development, breeding, and also in more recent times, perhaps, by biotechnology. Many of the toxicants in our food system we have learned over the ages to avoid or to make sure, for instance, that we cook these particular products. Sometimes various innocuous vegetables or plants in our diet are innocuous only when cooked. An example I give on this slide is red kidney beans. Not many of us refer to red kidney beans as the toxic red kidney beans. But if you chose to eat these, not necessarily cooked, but perhaps sitting them in cold water to soften them up and putting them in a bean salad, you would experience a very undesirable food poisoning. There's a compound in there, phytohemoagglutinin. This is a toxic lectin. Lectin in uncooked kidney beans, it is destroyed by cooking. Its reduction is on the order of 90%. Uncooked or partially cooked red kidney beans can give you a very undesirable toxic consequence, upset stomach, and in some cases with very high doses of these uncooked beans. And in children, this can be a fatal outcome. Our hazard or risks in terms of our interaction with phytochemicals can be modified by our dietary habits. Again, these dietary habits will dictate dose. What is the serving size of a particular plant material and therefore this dose that we are exposed to? There are also going to be genetic factors. Some individuals, whether it be by geographical family lineage in terms of idiosyncratic responses, or something a little bit more global in terms of a defining enzyme deficiency, these genetic factors will have an influence of whether or not an array of secondary plant chemical compounds will present a hazard or risk to that individual. There's also the concept of adaptation in terms of the ability to ramp up, if you will, the biotransformation mechanisms required to consume certain phytochemicals that might have a toxic effect in large doses, but in small doses maybe enhance, for instance, various biotransformation enzymes and therefore enhance our tolerance perhaps for a larger dose at a future time. Now, it's good for us also to stand back and look at the impact of plant toxicants in the human food chain. Not many of us go out necessarily and graze or pick our own salads, although some do. Livestock typically does not have this luxury, especially grazing livestock and free-range livestock. In terms of the impact of plant toxicants, this is estimated at about $300 to $400 million per year lost to producers. This is from the direct exposure to plants leading in death or illness, clinical disease, loss in body weight, reproductive failure, and sometimes abortion in secondary offspring. And so this is a significant impact in terms of the relationship of the human food chain. This is an economic impact and as well a toxicosis and animal toxicosis impact in the human food chain. In terms of our potential exposure via consumption of meat, this impact is considered to be of fairly low risk. It has a lot to do with the dilution of our meat sources. The commercial mechanisms of production and distribution and processing in the meat industry allow for a wide geographic distribution of food animal resources via imports, via different places in the United States. What happens is that from a larger or global point of view, our food supply is somewhat diluted. So that even if we were exposed to some plant toxicants, if it was an acute toxin, we might see something, but in terms of chronic toxicity, repeated consumption would not happen typically or necessarily in more commercial meat distribution outlets. Now, if an individual is doing self-slaughter, self-production of animals that are grazing in a localized or confined area, and that confined area is exposed, does present exposure to toxic plants, obviously the risk is significantly greater. In terms of the impact of plant toxicants in human health from drinking contaminated milk, this is plant toxin contaminated milk. Remember when we talked about the processes of toxicology, when we talked about biotransformation and elimination, we talked about the different mechanisms of elimination, and through or via milk, it is one process of potential elimination of consumed toxicants. In terms of the production risk, the consumption risk from commercial milk, this is a low risk, and this has a lot to do with dilution through bulk handling and also the management practices of large dairies. People will talk about corporate dairies, if you will, sometimes. Their approach in terms of food and feed management on a dairy is fairly high level. Mistakes do happen. Contamination and toxicosis does happen, but is at a rare occurrence. At commercial dairies, milk from various producers is blended together. This will have an overall effect of diluting any potential toxicant. Another impact in terms of minimal risk is taste factor. For those of you that ever have had free-range home-produced dairy, if there is not good control of the feed source, there sometimes can occur, for example, off tastes in the milk or in the case of meat animals in the meat itself. This has been observed, for instance, with the animals using wild onions as a grazing food during that time of the year, and the milk or meat products actually having an onion odor or flavor, an undesirable attribute. So in a certain sense, many of these compounds that you know, can present toxicosis and intoxication will also present sensory effects that are undesirable. This is not always the case. In terms of plant toxin contaminated milk, in terms of absorption, distribution, biotransformation, and excretion, we learned that there is a potential for the interaction of blood-bound toxicants in milk. The excretion of toxicants into milk by lactating animals is minor when compared to other routes of elimination, however, and this has much to do with the blood-milk barrier that we talked about. Plant toxins have been detected in the milk of animals grazing on toxic plants. The human health risk is generally small, again, for commercial milk because of the blending that occurs in large commercial dairy operations. Now remember that milk is an emulsion of lipids. It's in an aqueous solution of proteins. Any plant toxin or metabolite that is circulating in the blood can enter the milk. These toxicants can cross the mammary cell membranes by simple diffusion, and it can be carried across the blood-milk barrier, especially if it's lipophilic or bound to proteins. Some of the basic compounds, such as alkaloids, actually can be concentrated in milk because of the pH change between blood and milk. Milk is pH 6.5, and it is more acidic than plasma. Lipophilic compounds, because of the ability of the blood-milk barrier to transport more lipid-like molecules, allows for a transport of these potential compounds as well. Now, in terms of the range of compounds or toxicants that might be excreted via milk, trematol is one class, white snake group. We'll explore that a little bit more later in this lecture. Pyrrolizidine alkaloids, or PAs, from Senecio, Amsinthia, piperidine alkaloids from conium or poison hemlock, glucosinolates, we've talked about, quinolizidine alkaloids from lupin, we talked about in another case study. In terms of some of the risk factors associated with milk-borne toxins, obviously infants and very young children, because of the food intake to weight ratio, because of immature enzyme systems, are presented with a more significant risk. Consumption of milk produced by lactating mothers who are using potentially toxic herbal remedies is another vector for risk. The availability of toxic plants to grazing dairy animals is another factor, as is long-term health effects from the various low levels of plant toxicants that we might be exposed to. Chronic consumption of milk contaminated with specific plant toxicants. The other risk is consumption directly of milk from individual animals grazing on toxic plants in more of a home production or local production, rent-a-cow production, if you will, where this particular cow is actually exposed to secondary plant phytochemicals that have toxic properties. Now, in terms of their follow-up of impact of plant toxicants on human health, let's explore the consumption of toxin-contaminated eggs. Obviously, this is a food animal product, and the consumption is generally regarded as low. There's little known transfer to the egg, and this has a lot to do with the blood placental barrier, if you will, that exists in animals in terms of isolating reproduction from potential intoxication of the parent. It's not recognized as a major vector of toxin exposure. The bigger concerns about eggs have to do with infectious disease and foodborne pathogens. Now, what we're going to do here in this segment of the lecture is explore a couple of plant toxins in the human food chain. And the idea here is just to give you a brief overview of some of the sources and pathways, perhaps even the receptors and the clinical endpoints of some of these plant toxins. At first, we'll have Eupatorium rugosum. This is a perennial herb. It's often referred to under its common name, white snake root. It's found often in the eastern parts of the United States, in the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys. It's in moist, shaded, and uncultivated land. The common name for the clinical syndrome it produces is milk sickness, because it is presented in the human food chain through dairy products and milk products. In the early 1800s, it's been estimated that one quarter to one half of the deaths in Indiana and Ohio were due to milk sickness and the presentation of this toxicant in the human food chain. It did affect even Abraham Lincoln's mother, who passed away when from milk poisoning, milk sickness, when Abraham Lincoln was about 9 or 10 years old. I think he had an aunt and an uncle that died of milk sickness as well. White snake root, the toxins associated with it were identified in 1910, trimetrol. It interferes with the Krebs cycle and glucose metabolism. We still find sporadic problems in rural areas, and again, from instances of very intimate milk production in terms of the dairy cow living on a farm and having access, and then the family having using this particular cow and cow's milk over a long period of time. It is a cumulative problem. It is a fat-soluble lipophilic compound, and so there is a chronic exposure concern. The risks from white snake root associated with milk, that the toxins are excreted by the cow, so the cow is actually not affected. This particular toxin is not destroyed during pasteurization. It's fat soluble, so it can actually collect in the butter in high concentrations. In meat, we find that it has a fairly long half-life in terms of animals that have been grazed free range, perhaps exposed to this particular toxic plant, and then brought into a feedlot in terms of changing the overall diet of the animal and therefore the flavor of the meat. Clinical signs of white snake root: weight loss, listlessness, weakness, tremors, collapse, death within days to weeks. In the case of Lincoln's mother, it took months, and this is an uncomfortable toxicosis. The next category of plant toxins, the solanum, and this is lycopersicon. These come from nightshades, plants, potato plants, eggplants, tomato plants, as I introduced earlier today. These are in categories of food, noxious weeds, ornamentals, and in some cases, herbal medicines. They can be annuals or perennials. There's about 100 species of solanum. The poisonings in people have been documented through the consumption of berries, consumption of impacted tubers with sprouts, for instance, potato tubers, and leaves and stem of these particular plants, the non-edible components of these plants. The toxins include glycoalkaloids. These are anticholinergics, saponins that exist in these plants. Some of the compounds, the alkaloids, solanidine, tomatidine, solanidine, tomatine, chaconine, and solanine. And the difference in the names has to do whether or not there is the sugar group still on the alkaloid. These alkaloids are heat stable. The flowers contain more than the sprouts. The peel and the eyes contain more than the shoots or the tubers. There is an increase with greening, and so what your mother told you about not eating green potatoes is true. There is a decrease in maturity. So young sprouts of these plants, for example, when livestock escape into a potato patch, there is a strong potential for toxicosis from grazing on the green parts of these plants. The clinical presentation is digestive and neurological problems, nausea, vomiting, cramping, and diarrhea, muscle tremors, staggers, weakness in animals, The consumption of blighted potatoes in Ireland historically has led to fetal deformities, so there is teratogenesis potential from these secondary plant chemical compounds. The next category of plant chemicals is the PAs, or pyrrolizidine alkaloids. They come from the genera of Senecio, for example, Amsichnia, Cinchia. These are hepatotoxic alkaloids. They are found they can be found in meat residues, in milk residues. Because of the interaction of insects and plants in terms of pollination, they can also be found in honey residues of areas where these types of plants grow. They're found in various herbal teas, historically and currently, and in several dietary supplements. The risk in terms of acute toxicosis is typically low. Chronic toxicosis is a little bit more of a problem. For example, home slaughter of animals bred on the farm, where they do have chronic exposure to plants containing pyrrolizidine alkaloids and the chance to impact the local food chain. PAs are hepatotoxins. They're responsible for a veno-occlusive disease. We can find this in chronic consumption of herbal teas. Many of these plants are used in wound healing, like comfrey. Its astringent properties are fine for external use only. They're not good as comfrey tea. They're found occasionally in dietary supplements. They are somehow also known as anti-cancer compounds and remedies in terms of dietary supplement markets. They can be found as a contaminant in cereal grains and some bread products. This, if you recall, was the metabolic profile for pyrrolizidine alkaloids. We have this general alkaloid bicyclic formate, hydrolysis to retronesine, and then finally hydroxyhex-2-enol, which is a chemical compound that can be bound to liver tissue and is probably responsible for the hepatotoxicity that we observe with PAs. The pyrrolizidine alkaloids are regarded as mutagenic, teratogenic, phytotoxic, and carcinogenic. We've seen epidemiological relationships between Senecio and liver neoplasia in various populations in South Africa. This is a picture of tansy ragwort, a member of the Senecio family. Another plant toxin is the bracken fern. This is Pteridium aquilinum. There's worldwide distribution in terms of this particular plant. It's used in the production of flour from its rhizomes in Europe, New Zealand, and Australia. The fronds, or the croziers, the top part of the plant, is found in Japan, Hawaii, and Brazil, eaten fresh, cooked, and preserved. There is a potential in terms of grazing animals for meat and milk contamination. The toxin is tocilizide. It's carcinogenic. It's known to be linked to esophagus, stomach, and white blood cell cancer or leukemia. There's been epidemiological linking of esophageal tumors in Japan. This brings us to quick examination of herbs and supplements as a plant food in the human food chain. In 1994, Congress passed the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, DSHEA. Essentially, it, for the first time, actually created a different category for these supplements, referring to them as food products, not as medicinals. Drug manufacturers that produce medicines have to prove their products are safe under DSHEA. The FDA has to prove that a product is unsafe before commanding it off the market. This may take years, and so there's potential exposure during the appearance of a product and its impact on human populations. Many folks are seeking complementary and alternative medicine Under survey, this represents about 36% of adults in the U.S. About 19% actually will use natural products. And in 1997, this marketplace was $36 to $47 billion. This is a fairly large part of the health economy. A recent incident in December 2003, FDA banned ephedra products from the marketplace. These are typically were marketed as weight loss aids, energy supplements. Earlier that year, a 23-year-old Major League Baseball pitcher, Steve Beckler, actually died from ephedrine, the active compound in these ephedra dietary supplements. These products, although you won't find them on the shelf in the marketplace, they still are available over the internet. In the previous 5 years, from 2003, there were almost 15,000 adverse events reported from ephedra use. That included 18 heart attacks, 26 strokes, 43 seizures, and 5 deaths. In terms of how the dietary supplement market has responded to the removal of ephedra, ephedrine containing ephedrine, which is very close to amphetamine and methamphetamine in terms of its chemical structure, two products have appeared: bitter orange, which is epinephrine, and green tea extract, which contains caffeine and catechins in terms of stimulant activity. Another herbal that is significant in the U.S. marketplace, it's the second most popular herb with annual sales of about over $100 million, is St. John's wort. It has a remarkable use in history over centuries to treat mild to moderate depression. There's many active ingredients, hypericin, hyperforum are two of them. This is a fairly common herbal. Some of the concerns associated with St. John's wort include its induction of the cytochrome P450 metabolic pathway. This is an important pathway, and so, for instance, if you are on a sustaining medication, for instance, contraceptives or heart medication, induction of this pathway will speed up metabolism of the drugs that you are taking, decrease the therapeutic concentration, and so you won't have the benefit of these very expensive medicines that you are on. So this is one of the precautions about St. John's wort. As well, there seems to be a photochemical, photophytotoxic reaction, and there is recommendations that you do not go out in the sun when you're using this product for prolonged time periods. Some other plant supplements, and this is a collection of pretty much just names and outcomes. These are plant supplements that are of concern because of their potential for toxicosis, especially with chronic use. The clinical literature has many citations about various sorts of human disease endpoints associated typically with chronic use of these plant supplements. Aristolochic acid found in Aristolochia, carcinogens, kidney failure, chaparral, you can search Mortality and Morbidity Weekly and find incidences of liver hepatotoxicosis associated with chaparral in California. Lobelia yields clinical respiratory challenges, low blood pressure and heart rate, diarrhea, dizziness, and death. Germander has a toxic impact on the liver. Kava root, which is popular as a tea, has a potential for liver damage. I've given a 1937 quote from the book Savage Civilization about the writer's interpretation of his first experience with kava root tea. Your head is affected most pleasantly, thoughts come clearly, you feel friendly, never cross, you cannot hate with kava in you. Pennyroyal oil, yielding liver and kidney damage in chronic use. Skullcap, liver damage. Yohimbe bark, it's used to deal with impotence. There's been observations of drop in blood pressure, heart arrhythmias, and heart failure associated with Yohimbe use. Well, the next segment of the lecture, we're going to cross over into the world of fungus and talk a little bit about mushroom toxins. Now, mushroom poisoning is caused by the consumption of raw or cooked, the fruiting bodies, the mushrooms or toadstools, of a number of species of higher fungi. The term toadstool actually comes from the German translating death stool, toadstool. What we find in terms of the interaction of humans and fungus is that there is no real clear rule of thumb to identify edible mushrooms from poisonous toadstools. And so the recommendation I will tell you all is that if you are not an expert or not with an expert, to avoid picking your own mushrooms in your next nature hike. Most mushrooms that cause poisoning cannot be made non-toxic by processing or cooking. And the only way to avoid intoxication is by avoiding the mushrooms themselves. Mushroom poisoning occurs mostly when wild mushroom hunters and especially novices misidentify and consume a toxic species. Sometimes we have incidents where recent immigrants to the United States or to the Americas see a species, a type of mushroom that resembles one that that was edible in their native land, and in fact the difference of species might actually have a toxic impact. We also find individuals that desire the neurotoxic effects of several species of mushrooms, there can be poisoning associated with the psychotropic aspects of mushrooms, as well as the intoxicating aspect of these types of mushrooms. We can take the physiological effects of mushroom toxins and put them into four broad categories. These categories are protoplasmic poisons, and these result in a generalized destruction of cells. And this is typically followed by organ failure. These are the most deadly class of category of mushrooms. The neurotoxic effects of the next category of mushrooms cause neurological symptoms such as profuse sweating, coma, convulsions, hallucinations. These are the psychedelic mushrooms, perhaps, if you will. And then the next category is the GI irritants. These will produce rapid transient nausea, vomiting, abdominal cramping, and diarrhea. And then the final class is a class of mushrooms that have disulfiram-like toxins. These toxins actually act like the medicinal compound disulfiram in that it interacts in a very, very aggressively negative way when alcohol is consumed within about a day or two of consumption of these mushrooms. Now, the protoplasmic poisons associated with mushroom toxicosis, one of the examples is mushrooms containing cyclic peptides. Again, this is the most deadly category. For example, Amanita or death caps in this particular image. These mushrooms are associated with roots of trees. They produce amatoxins and phallotoxins. These inhibit nuclear RNA polymerase and protein synthesis. There is a delayed onset characteristic of protoplasmic poisons as opposed to some other mushroom toxins. It targets the gastrointestinal tract, the kidney, and the liver, and there's about a 50 to 90% death rate with a large enough dose with this particular type of mushroom. This particular type of mushroom is the one that you see perhaps in the cinema associated with mushroom toxicosis. And one of the ways, one of the reasons it was popular for criminal poisoning is because of the delayed onset of symptoms. A nice mushroom soup today would not bring on toxicosis, perhaps, until about 6 to 48 hours, with an average of about 6 to 15 hours. So the patient doesn't show symptoms in this early stage. At the end of this early stage, you find the individual with a sudden severe seizure of abdominal pain, persistent vomiting and watery diarrhea, extreme thirst and lack of urine production. If the individual survives this particular phase, they may recover for a short period of time, but this period will be followed by a rapid and severe loss of strength, prostration, and pain-caused restlessness. This will be followed by death in about 50 to 90% of the cases from progressive and irreversible liver, kidney, cardiac, and skeletal muscle damage. And the disease may last 6 to 8 days of a very painful presentation, 4 to 6 days in children. 2 or 3 days after the onset of this latter phase due to multi-organ failure, the individual is jaundiced, cyanotic, and experiences coldness of the skin. Death is usually follows a period of coma and occasionally convulsions, a very unpleasant toxicosis. And again, this is the one that's characterized typically in terms of the major risk of mushroom toxins. The next class of category of mushroom toxins are the neurotoxins, for example, the ibotenic acid and muscimol toxins. These are from the Amanita class as well, such as the Amanita muscaria, or fly agaric, a very colorful mushroom that you may have seen in nature. Looks like a fairy mushroom, if you will. The toxins are neurotransmitters. These are typically regarded as false neurotransmitters. In terms of physiology, these compounds have helped us actually understand neurological physiology. It affects serotonin, noradrenaline, dopamine, and its effects in terms of its psychotropic effects are similar to those of LSD. The onset comes 30 to 90 minutes after consuming. The peak happens in about 2 to 3 hours. There's some initial abdominal discomfort. The symptoms include dizziness, drowsiness, and hyperactivity, excitability. Fatalities rarely occur in adults, although overdose in children has been observed. Next categories of mushroom toxins are the GI irritants. There's many types of mushrooms that will produce this. The one I have pictured here is the jack-o'-lantern. This is different from the first category in that we have rapid onset of clinical signs and symptoms. It's an emetic, so there's vomiting and diarrhea involved. It's short-lived. It's rare that it is fatal, and the fatalities that do occur occur because of dehydration. Clinical therapy and treatment is focused on hydration and emesis. The final category of mushroom toxins is the disulfiram-like toxins. Disulfiram, under its commercial name, Antabuse, is a chemical compound that is taken by people who are alcoholics. This particular chemical circulating in your bloodstream gives you alcohol aversion. You become very sick if you consume alcohol. What happens with this particular mushroom, which is regarded as an edible mushroom, it's edible if you don't follow it with that nice glass of Chianti. There no illness results when eaten in the absence of alcoholic beverages for a period of about 72 hours. This particular mushroom that's pictured here, the inky cap, is the dominant mushroom in this category. It has a unusual amino acid that I've pictured here, coprine. This particular compound is converted to a cyclopropanone hydrate in the human body, and this particular compound is the one that interferes with alcohol metabolism. So this is a toxic syndrome that if you do consume alcoholic beverages, you'll have a headache, nausea, vomiting, flushing, and cardiovascular disturbances. Not a good occasion. So the risk in here is consumption of alcohol following the consumption of this particular mushroom. Well, that gives you something to think about, I guess, in terms of what we've tried to discuss today in the concept of the ecology of food. We tried to at least visit the propagation of plant toxins, these secondary chemical compounds, in the human food chain. The next time we visit, what we'll do is actually talk more about the fungal kingdom and talk about toxic mold and mycotoxins. Until that time, we'll see you. Thanks.